under the section entitled Prison Phone Calls, in Diaz, on page 147, the court rejected defendant's argument that he did not consent to the release of the prosecution of recordings of his phone conversations from jail. Defendant acknowledged he was aware the conversations could be monitored and recorded, but noted that the stated reason for recording in the jail handbook was for jail security. The Second Department instructed that the better practice would be to notify inmates the recordings could be turned over to the prosecution. In Vining, on page 147, the Court of Appeals determined the trial court did not abuse its discretion when it allowed in evidence as a potential adoptive admission in a recorded phone call between the defendant and the victim. The phone call was recorded by the jail when defendant was incarcerated. Defendant's silence and evasiveness when the victim told him he had broken her ribs was the essence of the potential adoptive admission. The jury was instructed that defendant's silence and evasiveness could be considered by them, but it was up to them to determine whether the silence and evasiveness was an admission. In the Mason case, on page 148, the First Department held defendant had impliedly consented to the recording of his phone calls from jail. In the words of the court, defendant impliedly consented to the recording of the calls based on his receipt of multiple forms of notice that his calls would be recorded, and he was not entitled to separate notice that the calls might be subpoenaed by prosecutors. The next case deals with a civil remedy in a criminal case, the doctrine of prohibition. In Clark, on page 149, the First Department determined the trial court should not have applied the collateral estoppel doctrine to preclude the people from introducing evidence the defendant used a firearm to threaten the robbery victim. The grand jury dismissed the robbery first count and indicted on robbery third. The trial court reasoned that the grand jury necessarily found the defendant did not have a weapon by refusing to indict on robbery first. The First Department held, 1. The Article 78 proceeding seeking a writ of prohibition brought by the people against the trial judge was the appropriate remedy, and 2. The trial judge is prohibited from enforcing the order precluding evidence of the defendant's possession of a weapon. The court wrote, the trial court's ruling in this case was an error that affected the entire proceeding and thus constituted an excess of the court's authority. The ruling prevents the people from proving the element of force required under the third-degree robbery because the gun was the only evidence of force that was presented to the grand jury. A writ of prohibition will lie where a trial court's erroneous ruling affects the proceeding in a conclusive manner by terminating the case. At bar, although the ruling did not actually terminate the case, it effectively terminated the ability of the people to prosecute the highest count in the indictment. We therefore find that the court's ruling is reviewable by way of a writ of prohibition. The next section deals with prosecution misconduct or mistakes. In the Cassiano case on page 150, the court determined the prosecutor's remarks in summation amounted to prosecutorial misconduct. The court wrote, the prosecutor vouched for the credibility of the people's witnesses with regard to significant aspects of the people's case by asserting that the witnesses who came before you provided truthful testimony that makes sense, that they gave the kind of truthful and credible testimony that you can rely on, and that one witness had no reason to be anything but truthful with the 911 operator. In describing a complainant, the prosecutor asserted that he was exactly what you hoped to see from someone who had troubles with the law in their youth, but had changed his life and now worked at an organization that helps low-income people obtain health care, which was a clear attempt to appeal to the sympathy of the jury. To support the credibility of that same complainant, the prosecutor injected the integrity of the district attorney's office into the trial to downplay the severity of a past criminal charge he faced. Further, the prosecutor denigrated the defense and undermined the defendant's right to confront witnesses by implying that the complainants were victims of an overly long cross-examination and that one was a saint for answering so many questions. Moreover, the prosecutor improperly used the defendant's right to pretrial silence against him by arguing that he could not be a victim as he did not call 911. The cumulative effect of these improper comments deprived the defendant of a fair trial. In Wilson, on pages 151 and 152, the court determined defendant was entitled to a hearing on his motion to withdraw his guilty plea based upon the people's failure to disclose the autopsy and toxicology reports relating to the two persons on a motorcycle who died after colliding with defendant's truck. The reports indicated high blood alcohol levels. The Fourth Department noted that the reports constituted Brady material and held that a defendant does not waive a Brady violation by pleading guilty. Prior Fourth Department decisions to the contrary are no longer to be followed. In Morrison, on page 154, the court determined the prosecution could not use the doctrine of collateral estoppel to fulfill its proof requirements at the grand jury stage. Defendant had been convicted of attempted murder, which included the intent to kill. After the victim died, the people indicted the defendant for murder. The grand jury was told the intent element had already been proven, and the grand jury need only consider causation. The Third Department noted the difference between the application of collateral estoppel in civil and criminal cases. From the defendant's perspective, using the collateral estoppel doctrine in this context violated defendant's constitutional rights. In Powell, on page 159, the Second Department determined that the prosecutor's overstatement of the value of the DNA evidence in reference to facts not in evidence, specifically what the defendant had said to her, the district attorney, deprived the defendant of a fair trial. The court wrote, "In light of the powerful influence of DNA evidence on juries, the opportunity for juror confusion regarding the limited probative value of the DNA methodology employed in this case and the qualified nature of the test results, the prosecutor engaged in misconduct when she misrepresented and overstated the probative value of the DNA evidence by telling the jury that the defendant's DNA was on the safety of the murder weapon. As a result, the defendant was deprived of his right to a fair trial. The statements by the prosecutor improperly encouraged inferences of guilt based on facts not in evidence, improperly injected her own credibility into the trial, and improperly vouched for the credibility of a witness for the people." In Flores, on pages 159 and 160, the Second Department held that the prosecutorial misconduct alone justified reversal. In the words of the court, "The prosecutor engaged in misconduct throughout his summation by continuously referring to the defendant as a liar, misstating evidence, denigrating the defense, shifting the burden of proof, attempting to arouse the sympathies of the jurors, and vouching for his witness's credibility. The cumulative effect of the prosecutor's improper comments deprived defendant of a fair trial." In the Perkins case, on pages 160 and 161, the Third Department reversed defendant's conviction because he was not allowed to call an alibi witness. The defendant had not served a notice of alibi, as required by CPL 250.20, but the prosecutor, who knew the defendant had testified about an alibi before the grand jury, directly asked the defendant at trial what he was doing on the night of the shooting. The defendant then asked for permission to call the alibi witness. The prosecutor objected, and the court denied the request. The third department held that the prosecutor had opened the door to the alibi evidence and had created the issue. The next topic is the prosecutor's impeachment of the people's own witness. In Gaston, on page 162, the court determined the people should not have been allowed to impeach their own witness, named Abelman, with a prior inconsistent statement which did not contradict the people's theory of prosecution. The court wrote, Abelman indicated in a written statement to investigators and testimony before the grand jury that defendant was his heroin supplier and that defendant's heroin was stashed at the apartment. Abelman testified at trial, however, that he did not know defendant, had never bought drugs from defendant, and did not recall ever having been to the apartment. He did not call defendant's connection to the heroin into question and only maintained that he had no knowledge of whatever connection there might be. This claimed lack of knowledge merely failed to corroborate or bolster the people's case and did not affirmatively contradict or disprove evidence presented by them. In Ellison, on pages 162 and 163, the court determined the people were properly allowed to impeach their own witness when the witness testified she did not see the driver of the car from which shots were fired. She had previously stated the defendant was the driver. The court wrote, "We conclude that the testimony of the witness denying that she saw the driver related to a material fact, the identity of the shooter, and affirmatively damaged the people's case, particularly because the victim did not testify." In Grierson, on page 163, the third department, reversing the conviction, determined the people should not have been allowed to impeach their own witness. Although Grierson testified before the grand jury that she told the police officers about her previous conversation with defendant concerning a gun and her belief, based on that conversation, that defendant might have a gun in the apartment, at trial she denied that she made those statements to the officers. Grierson's trial testimony did not tend to disprove the people's position that defendant constructively possessed the gun, nor did it affirmatively damage their case. Rather, Grierson's trial testimony merely failed to corroborate or bolster the officer's explanatory background testimony. The next topic is psychiatric evidence. In Kajah, I believe it is, on page 164, the court, reversing defendant's rape conviction, determined Supreme Court should have ordered the victim's psychiatric records for an in-camera review for relevance. In the court's words, defendant requested that the court issue a subpoena ducis tecum to obtain the victim's mental health records and conduct an in-camera review to ascertain whether they contained any information relevant and material to the victim's credibility. Without knowing the content of those files, we are unable to determine whether the information that they contain is merely cumulative to the information provided to defendant about the victim's mental health history that was used as a basis for cross-examination, or whether the records contain additional relevant and material information bearing on her credibility. Similarly, our lack of knowledge of the contents of the victim's mental health records precludes us from determining whether the court's error in this regard was harmless. Accordingly, the judgment of conviction must be reversed and the matter remitted for a new trial. In Diaz, on page 165, the third department held that whether to introduce psychiatric evidence is a strategic decision to be made by defense counsel, not the defendant. The court wrote, "The decision of whether to present psychiatric evidence in furtherance of the affirmative defense of not criminally responsible by reason of mental disease or defect is a strategic decision involving the exercise of professional judgment over which defense counsel retains ultimate decision-making authority." Additionally, the record reflects that defense counsel fully investigated a possible psychiatric defense and, having done so, made a calculated trial strategy to fashion a different defense. The next topic is right to counsel. In Henry, on page 169, the Court of Appeals, reversing the appellate division, held that questioning defendant about a murder when defendant was represented on a marijuana charge did not violate defendant's right to counsel because the marijuana charge was completely unrelated to the murder. The court wrote, "The purpose of the rule is to protect the right to counsel once it has attached. If the questioning on the unrepresented charge will inevitably lead to statements about the represented charge, the statements should be suppressed. However, if the relationship between the unrepresented and the represented charges is insufficient, then discreet questioning on the unrepresented charge by a police officer mindful and respectful of the indelible attachment of defendant's right to counsel on the represented charge would not create any serious risk of incriminating responses to the latter crime." In Silvagnolia, on page 169, a case decided on the same day as the case I just summarized, the Henry case, reversing the First Department, the Court of Appeals held that brief questioning on a drug charge on which defendant was represented during questioning about a murder did not violate defendant's right to counsel. The court wrote, "The impermissible questioning of defendant on a represented matter was so brief, flippant, and minimal that it was discreet and fairly separable as a matter of law from the interrogation of defendant on an unrepresented matter." In Lentini, on pages 170 and 171, the Third Department reversed defendant's conviction in this felony leaving the scene of an accident case because a pretrial ruling that defendant could not be questioned about seeking to communicate with counsel was violated twice by witnesses. A mistrial should have been granted. The court wrote, "Defendant's strategy at trial relied in large part upon the fact that she was not at fault in the accident, but did witness the victim's body being propelled through her windshield and coming to rest inches away from her. She relied upon this state of affairs to contend that her failure to contact authorities was not because she was coldly calculating, but because she was in shock and incapable of doing so. Defendant further questioned the proof supporting the people's hypothesis that she left the scene with her sister before the 911 call. Any indication that defendant sought to consult with counsel would undermine the foundation of this defense by prejudicially suggesting that she was conscious of guilt, rational enough to consider the question of counsel, and perhaps capable of reporting the accident or taking steps to avoid doing so. In our view, the repeated violations of the pretrial ruling in a case where defendant's capacity to act and her actions after the accident were in serious dispute caused harm that could not reliably dissipated. County court therefore abused its discretion in declining to declare a mistrial." In Johnson, on page 171, the Second Department reversed defendant's conviction because the detective conducting the lineup identification procedure was aware defendant was represented by counsel but did not inform counsel of the lineup. The court wrote, "The detective who conducted the lineup violated the defendant's right to counsel by failing to notify counsel of the lineup and afford counsel a reasonable opportunity to attend. As a general rule, a defendant does not have the right to counsel at a pre-accusatory investigatory lineup. There are two exceptions. The first is when a defendant is actually represented by an attorney in the matter under investigation. That occurs when the defendant is, in fact, represented in the matter and the police know or can be charged with knowledge of that representation. The second is when a defendant who is already in custody and represented by an attorney in an unrelated case invokes the right by requesting his or her attorney. In either case, once the right to counsel has been triggered, the police may not proceed with the lineup without at least apprising the defendant's lawyer of the situation and affording the lawyer a reasonable opportunity to appear. A specific request that the lineup not proceed until counsel is so notified need not be made. In Lamb, on pages 172 and 173, the Second Department annulled the finding that defendant driver had refused a blood alcohol test. Although the driver was warned that a refusal required the revocation of his license, he was not told that waiting for a return call from his attorney had been deemed a refusal by the arresting officer. In Lewis, on page 173, the Fourth Department, reversing county court, determined defendant had asserted his right to counsel by saying he would not go to the police station without a parent or an attorney. Therefore, the motion to suppress the subsequent statement should have been granted. Before the defendant went to the station, the police, at defendant's request, took the defendant to see a man defendant described as like a father to him. The man accompanied the police and the defendant to the station and spoke with the defendant before the defendant waived his rights and made a statement. But the defendant's statement initially, when the police first arrived, that he didn't want to go to the police station without an attorney or a parent, was deemed an assertion of his right to counsel. In Suero, on page 173, the First Department noted that a text message from defendant indicating he needed money just in case for a lawyer should not have been admitted in evidence in this homicide case. The error was deemed harmless, however. Okay, at this point, I'm going to insert the second code word for this criminal evidence update CLE. The second word to place on your form, the second code word, is appeal. Again, the second code word for this CLE, criminal evidence update 2019, is appeal. The next topic is Sandoval. In Calderon, on page 174, the court, reversing defendant's conviction over a dissent, determined the Sandoval ruling erroneously allowed cross-examination about a prior crime. The defendant chose not to testify, and the proof was deemed far from overwhelming. During the prior crime, a robbery, defendant held a knife to the victim's throat. In the rape trial at issue, it was alleged the defendant held a knife to the victim's throat. The court wrote, "While we recognize that under Sandoval and its progeny, the mere similarity of crimes or conduct to the charge for which a defendant stands trial does not automatically preclude inquiry. Here, under the particular facts and circumstances of this case, a proper balancing of the probative value with the issue of credibility against the risk of unfair prejudice to the defendant should have resulted in a ruling precluding the people's proposed line of questioning." In Wahab, on page 177, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined the trial court's allowing Sandoval evidence of a prior robbery, which was the subject of a pending appeal, was error, and the error was not harmless under the facts. Next, we look at sentencing. In the Brani case on page 178, the Court of Appeals determined there was sufficient evidence the burglary and murder were separate acts to justify consecutive sentences. The defendant was charged with breaking and entering his girlfriend's home, dragging her downstairs, and then murdering her. court wrote, "The evidence of a small amount of blood upstairs, as compared with the large amount downstairs, supports the determination of the courts below that defendant used a dangerous instrument to cause physical injury to the victim upstairs and then, as he admitted, dragged her down the stairs and murdered her in a separate and distinct act." In Bautista, on pages 178 and 179, the court determined that the attempted kidnapping conviction merged with the sexual abuse and assault convictions. The court wrote, "Because the conduct underlying the charge of attempted kidnapping in the second degree was simultaneous to and inseparable from the conduct underlying the charges of sexual abuse in the first degree and assault in the second degree, we must apply the doctrine of merger, reverse defendant's conviction of attempted kidnapping in the second degree, and dismiss that count of the indictment." Here, the victim's testimony, as well as the surveillance footage, established that the defendant immediately began punching the victim upon opening the door to her vehicle, and that after dragging her roughly 58 feet, he continued to punch the victim while forcibly subjecting her to sexual contact. This brutal encounter lasted between 3 and 4 minutes. Under these circumstances, because the conduct underlying the charge of attempted kidnapping in the second degree was simultaneous to and inseparable from the conduct underlying the charges of sexual abuse in the first degree and assault in the second degree, we must apply the doctrine of merger, reverse defendant's conviction of attempted kidnapping in the second degree, and dismiss that count of the indictment. In Henderson, on page 179, the court determined defendant should have been sentenced concurrently for his 2 assault convictions. The victim was stabbed 20 times and his face was slashed. Defendant was convicted of 2 counts of assault first, intent to disfigure and intent to cause serious injury. It was not possible to determine whether the jury convicted on both counts based upon only the slashing of victim's face, as opposed to 2 different counts, 2 different acts. In Minimier, on pages 179 and 180, the Court of Appeals determined the sentencing court's failure to inform defendant of the nature of a confidential document included in the pre-sentence report and relied upon by the sentencing judge violated defendant's due process rights. In Anonymous, on page 180, the First Department held that the record of an acquittal should not have been unsealed for use by the sentencing court, but the error did not require resentencing. The court wrote, in People v. Patterson, a Court of Appeals case, the Court of Appeals held that suppression was not required where the people obtained identification evidence in violation of CPL 160.50, and the witness then identified the defendant in court. The court ruled that there is nothing in the history of CPL 160.50 or related statutes indicating a legislative intent to confer a constitutionally derived substantial benefit such that the violation of that statute without more would justify invocation of the exclusionary rule with respect to subsequent independent and unrelated criminal proceedings. We conclude that defendant is entitled to no greater relief based on the statutory violation that resulted in the court's consideration of the improperly unsealed information at sentencing than he would have been entitled to had the information been admitted at trial. So that statute that's mentioned in that quotation from the court, the CPL 160.50, is a statute that requires sealing of the records of certain proceedings, including acquittals. In Mangarillo, on pages 180 and 181, the court determined the people did not demonstrate the 2 sexual offenses to which defendant pled guilty occurred at different times. Therefore, consecutive sentences should not have been imposed. The third department explained that only the accusatory instrument to which defendant pled, here it was a superior court information, and the plea allocution can be considered in this context. To the extent that a prior ruling suggested admissions in a pre-sentence report and victim statements could be considered to determine the facts of the offenses, that ruling is no longer to be followed. In Newman, on page 181, the second department determined the sentencing court erroneously considered a crime of which defendant was acquitted in sentencing, requiring resentencing. The second department further noted that the people did not demonstrate that the assault and robbery convictions were based on different underlying facts. Therefore, the sentences must run concurrently. In Lopez, on page 181, the court determined firing 13 shots from a rooftop into a group of people, killing one and wounding two, resulting in a murder and two assault convictions, were not separate events which would support consecutive sentences. In Stein, on page 182, the third department determined sentences for three counts of possession of a sexual performance of a child should have been concurrent because neither the indictment nor the plea allocution established that the digital images came into defendant's possession at different times. In Mall, on page 182, the fourth department held that consecutive sentences for murder and criminal possession of a weapon were illegal. The court wrote, "The sentence on the murder conviction should run concurrently with the sentence on the weapon possession conviction that requires unlawful intent, because the latter offense was not complete until the defendant shot the victim." In Klaus, on pages 182 and 183, the Fourth Department held that imposing a sentence of incarceration after a probation violation in this vehicular manslaughter case, although the sentence was legal and not an abuse of discretion, was unduly harsh and severe. The sentence was reduced to probation with community service. The court wrote, "Although we conclude that the court did not abuse its discretion in revoking defendant's probation and sentencing her to an indeterminate term of incarceration, we can nevertheless substitute our own discretion for that of a trial court that has not abused its discretion in the imposition of a sentence. In consideration of all the circumstances, including a single low positive reading for marijuana approximately 1 year prior to her grandfather's death that did not result in a violation petition against defendant, the probation officer recommended against incarceration given that defendant was otherwise compliant with the terms of probation until her failure to report on four occasions. Further, the record establishes that defendant was employed on a full-time basis, intended to re-enroll in college classes, and committed no crimes after the underlying conviction." In Smith, on page 183, the second department determined the sentences for possession of three weapons should have been concurrent. There was no evidence the constructive possession of the weapons occurred at different times. The court wrote, "The mere fact that the defendant possessed three guns does not prove three separate acts of possession, and to the extent that our decisions in People v. Horn and People v. Negron can be read to so hold, those cases should no longer be followed." In Bailey, on page 184, the second department held that the possession of three weapons did not warrant three consecutive sentences. No facts were alleged in the superior court information or elicited at the plea allocution, which established three separate acts of possession. Turning to the sentencing of second felony offenders, in Heisler, on pages 185 and 186, the court noted that the people's motion to set aside defendant's sentence based upon an illegal sentence was properly brought and granted. Where the criteria are met, sentencing a defendant as a predicate felon is mandatory. Defendant should have been so sentenced but was not. Where a defendant is in fact a predicate offender, Sentencing the defendant as a non-predicate results in a legal in an illegal sentence. In Fenner on page 188, the court determined the failure to file a predicate felony statement required resentencing, despite the failure to preserve the issue by an appropriate motion. In Spencer on page 188, the Second Department determined the required information was not included in the predicate felony statement. The sentence was vacated in the interest of justice. The court wrote, "The predicate felony statement filed by the people did not set forth the dates of the defendant's incarceration since the commission of his prior felony in 1996, as required by Criminal Procedure Law Section 400.21, Subdivision 2. Consequently, the people failed to establish a sufficient tolling period to qualify the defendant's 1996 conviction as a predicate felony under Penal Law Section 70.06. In Funk, on page 188, the Fourth Department, in the interest of justice, determined a Pennsylvania burglary conviction was not the equivalent of a New York felony and could not be the basis of a second felony offender status. In Allison, on page 189, the First Department, in the interest of justice, held that a New Jersey forged instruments conviction was not the equivalent of a New York felony and could not be the basis of a second felony offender status. Under the topic persistent felony offender, in Ellison, on page 191, the Fourth Department drastically reduced defendant's sentence pursuant to a motion for a writ of coram nobis based on appellate counsel's failure to contend that the sentencing court abused its discretion in finding the defendant to be a persistent felony offender. The Fourth Department found that the sentencing court was not erroneous as a matter of law, because it did not act arbitrarily or irrationally. However, the Fourth Department noted that it has the authority to vacate a harsh or severe persistent felony offender finding pursuant to Criminal Procedure Law Section 470.20, and it did so. Defendant's 15-to-life sentence was reduced to an aggregate sentence of 5.5 to 11 years. The next topic is the Sex Offender Registration Act. In Current, on page 192, the court determined a sexual offense which defendant admitted committing, but with which he was never charged, could not be considered under risk factor 8. Court wrote, under the criminal history section of the RAI, the risk assessment instrument, 10 points may be assessed under risk factor 8, where the offender committed a sex offense that subsequently resulted in an adjudication or conviction for a sex crime at age 20 or less. The commentary similarly instructs, with regard to risk factor 8, that criminal convictions and youthful offender adjudications are to be considered in scoring this category, as well as risk factors 9, which is the number and nature of prior crimes, and 10, the recency of a prior felony or sex crime. To that end, the commentary specifically indicates that for purposes of the criminal history section of the RAI, the term crime includes criminal convictions and youthful offender adjudications, and that convictions for penal law offenses and unclassified misdemeanors should be considered. The commentary further clarifies that where an offender has admitted committing an act of sexual misconduct for which there has been no such judicial determination, it should not be used in scoring his or her criminal history. While proof of the commission of a prior sex crime committed by an offender at age 20 or under that did not result in a conviction or adjudication may be relied upon to argue in favor of an upward departure, the people did not request this alternative relief from county court at any point. In Gibson, on page 192, The Fourth Department, reversing county court, determined defendant's juvenile delinquency adjudication should not have been used to calculate his risk level under risk factor 9, which is the number and nature of offenses. In Simono, on page 193, the First Department noted that in a risk assessment procedure pursuant to the Sex Offender Registration Act, the State Board of Examiners, and therefore the court, may consider youthful offender-related documents. Supreme Court appropriately assessed points under risk factor 9 and 10 relating to defendant's prior youthful offender adjudication. In Maus, M-A-U-S, on page 193, the Third Department held that the judge's sua sponte departure from the board's recommendation required notice to the defendant and the opportunity for the defendant to object. In Trotter, on pages 193 and 194, the Second Department held there was insufficient evidence to support the assessment of points for substance abuse. The court wrote, the people did not meet their burden of proving the facts underlying the disputed point assessment by clear and convincing evidence. The pre-sentence report contained only ambiguous information about the extent of the defendant's use of alcohol and marijuana between the ages of 16 and 20, at least 7 years before the sex offense at issue in this proceeding, and no information about the defendant's use of those substances in the 7 years before the sex offense. Moreover, the evidence at the hearing did not establish that the defendant abused or was under the influence of alcohol or marijuana at the time of the offense. In Perez, on page 194, the Fourth Department held there was insufficient evidence the defendant and victim were strangers warranting a 20-point reduction. The court wrote, the 24-year-old defendant and the 16-year-old victim met while working at a local Red Cross. The two exchanged contact information and months later communicated through social media and by telephone before any sexual contact occurred. Under these circumstances, the people failed to establish by clear and convincing evidence that defendant and the victim were strangers at the time of the crime. Moreover, the people presented no evidence that defendant targeted the victim for the primary purpose of victimizing her. In Mota, on pages 194 and 195, the Second Department determined the evidence did not support an upward departure and explained the criteria for an upward departure. The court wrote, an upward departure is permitted only if the court concludes, upon clear and convincing evidence, that there exists an aggravating factor of a kind or to a degree not otherwise adequately taken into account by the guidelines. In determining whether an upward departure is permissible and, if permissible, appropriate, a SORA court must engage in a three-step inquiry. First, the court must determine whether the people have articulated as a matter of law a legitimate aggravating factor. Next, the court must determine whether the people have established by clear and convincing evidence the facts supporting the presence of that factor in the case before it. Upon the people's satisfaction of these two requirements, an upward departure becomes discretionary. If, upon examining all of the circumstances relevant to the offender's risk of reoffense and danger to the community, the court concludes that the presumptive risk level would result in an underassessment of the risk or danger of reoffense, it may upwardly depart. If, however, the people do not satisfy the first two requirements, the court does not have the discretion to depart from the presumptive risk level. In this case, the people failed at the hearing to identify an aggravating factor of a kind or to a degree not otherwise adequately taken into account by the guidelines. Specifically, the defendant's abuse of trust within a family relationship is already adequately accounted for by the guidelines. In Medina, on page 195, the Second Department determined defendant should have been given the opportunity to be heard on the judge's sua sponte sexual predator designation, and the appellate court deleted that designation. In Madonna, on page 196, the Fourth Department held there was insufficient evidence of a history of drug and alcohol abuse. The court wrote, at the SORA hearing, the people presented evidence that defendant drank one can of beer each month. We agree with defendant that such evidence was insufficient to warrant the assessment of points under risk factor 11. The people also presented evidence that defendant smoked marijuana in his teenage years and early 20s, but thereafter participated in a drug treatment program and, at the time of the pre-sentence interview, had not smoked marijuana for 4 years. We agree with defendant that the people's evidence established that his recent history of drug use was one of prolonged abstinence and was also insufficient to warrant the assessment of points under risk factor 11. The next topic is third-party culpability. In Davis, on page 199, the court determined defendant was entitled to a hearing on his motion to vacate the judgment of conviction. There was hearsay evidence that a third party committed the murder, and a hearing was necessary to determine the reliability of the hearsay. In addition, a hearing was required to determine whether defense counsel was ineffective in failing to investigate evidence that a third party committed the murder. In McFarland, on pages 199 and 200, the court, reversing Supreme Court, determined defendant's motion to vacate his conviction based upon newly discovered evidence of third-party culpability should have been granted. The statement at issue was admissible as a declaration against penal interest. The court wrote, we conclude that the third party is unavailable and that his alleged statement is supported by independent proof indicating that it is trustworthy and reliable, and thus that it is a statement against penal interest. Furthermore, the statement is clearly exculpatory of the defendant. We therefore conclude the defendant met his burden of establishing by a preponderance of the evidence that the third party's statement against penal interest was not available at the time of defendant's trial and is of such a character as to create a probability that had such evidence been received at the trial, the verdict would have been more favorable to the defendant. The next topic refers to a single case. It doesn't deal with a novel issue or a new issue, but it's worth mentioning in the context of the prohibition issue that we talked about earlier. Here, this was a case in Rochester where the judge, after the entire trial was over and the jury had been unable to reach a verdict, the judge granted the defense trial order of dismissal. And it went up to the Fourth Department because it was considered an erroneous ruling by the people. And of course, the Fourth Department had no choice but to find that the people did not have an option to appeal the denial of a trial order of dismissal. It's the Tan case on page 201. The court determined the people did not have statutory authority to appeal the grant of a trial order of dismissal after a mistrial had been declared because the jury could not reach a verdict. The Fourth Department explicitly stated that it had reviewed the evidence and found it legally sufficient to support the charge, which was murder. The trial order of dismissal then should not have been granted, but there was no mechanism for the people to appeal the error. And I'm wondering whether the First Department's finding that the remedy of prohibition against a trial judge in a criminal matter is viable if the judge makes a mistake that virtually terminates the prosecution. Now, in the language used by the First Department in that prohibition case, this Tan case would fit within the language used by the First Department, and it's worth considering whether that may have been a successful way to address the trial judge's error in the Tan case. The next topic is an uncharged theory that the jury is mistakenly or erroneously allowed to consider. Obviously, that results in a reversal whenever that happens. In the Morales case on page 202, the court determined that the harassment jury instruction was defective because it allowed the jury to convict on a theory that was not alleged in the indictment. The indictment charged defendant with harassment in the second degree on the ground that he slapped the complainant with the intent to harass, annoy, or alarm her. Nevertheless, the court instructed the jury that it could find him guilty if he shoved her or subjected her to other forms of physical contact. In Bradley, on page 203, the court, reversing defendant's conviction and dismissing the indictment, determined defendant was not tried on the allegations made in the indictment and bill of particulars. The defendant had a seizure while driving and struck two children, killing one of them. He was charged with reckless manslaughter and was convicted of criminally negligent homicide and assault in the third degree. The people specified only that the ingestion of marijuana and a failure to take medication were both factors that contributed to the defendant's recklessness. Despite defendant's objections during the course of the trial, including a motion for a trial order of dismissal at the close of the people's case and renewal of that motion at the close of all proof, the people presented evidence that defendant was reckless based not upon only marijuana use and the failure to take medication, but also based upon his lack of sleep, failure to inform his doctors of his fainting events, and failure to control his alcohol consumption. In Barber, on pages 203 and 204, the court found that a jury instruction on assault allowed the jury to consider a theory about how the victim was injured, which was not charged in the indictment. The court effectively instructed the jurors that in determining whether defendant was guilty of assault in the second degree, they could consider any injuries that the victim sustained when she threw herself from the moving vehicle. Inasmuch as those were not injuries that defendant caused by striking the victim, there is a possibility that the jury convicted defendant upon a theory different from the one charged in the indictment. In Vasquez, on pages 204 and 205, the court, reversing defendant's conviction, determined defendant was convicted of endangering the welfare of a child based upon a theory that was not charged in the indictment. The endangering count of the indictment alleged defendant had subjected the victim to several types of sexual touching, but not kissing. The jury was allowed to consider the evidence of kissing. The defendant was acquitted of all counts except the endangering count. The next topic is weight of the evidence. Obviously, weight of the evidence refers to an appellate review of a case, and an appellate court can act like a 13th juror and look at all the evidence at the trial, and even if it's found legally sufficient, in other words, even if it's found the people made out a prima facie case sufficient to get by a motion for a trial order of dismissal, the appellate court can look at the credibility of the witnesses and any other flaws that it might find in the evidence and decide whether the conviction is supported by the weight of the evidence, and if it isn't, they will reverse. In Farley, on page 209, the court, after conducting a weight of the evidence analysis, determined the proof was not sufficient to demonstrate beyond a reasonable doubt that defendant shared the intent of his son, who stabbed the victim 8 times. Therefore, the assault first conviction was reversed. The proof indicated that defendant may have been away from the victim, looking for his dog, when his son stabbed the victim. The court wrote, "We must independently assess all the proof, substitute our own credibility determinations for those made by the jury, if necessary, determine whether the verdict was factually correct, and acquit defendant if we are not convinced that the jury was justified in finding that guilt was proven beyond a reasonable doubt. In Vasquez on page 211, the Second Department held that defendants' child pornography convictions were against the weight of the evidence. The defendant, who speaks Spanish, gave a written statement in English acknowledging he had downloaded child pornography. However, it was revealed at trial that the police provided information that was in the statement and made changes to the statement without defendant's permission. The defendant had waived a pretrial Huntley hearing on the voluntariness of the statement, informing the judge he intended to challenge the voluntariness of the statement at trial. The judge in this bench trial erroneously ruled defendant had waived his right to challenge the statement at trial. The defendant testified that he did not download the child pornography and that he gave the statement to protect a family member. A family member testified and admitted unintentionally downloading the files. Defendant produced evidence he was at work when at least two of the files were downloaded. In Sanchez on page 214, the Court of Appeals held that the Appellate Division applied the correct analysis to its weight of the evidence review. The court wrote, "The Appellate Division applied the correct standard from Romero and Bleakley, which involves a two-step approach, wherein the court must, one, determine whether, based on all the credible evidence, an acquittal would not have been unreasonable, and two, weigh the relative probative force of conflicting testimony and the relative strength of conflicting inferences that may be drawn from the testimony." So we've reached the end of section one of this criminal evidence update 2019. Section one attempted to collect the cases that dealt with issues that are broadly applicable to various kinds of offenses, with the exception of hearsay and searches, which are in separate sections, sections three and four. Section two, the one we're moving to now, deals with evidentiary issues which relate to specific offenses or specific genres of offenses. The first category is assault. In Villanueva, on page 217, the court determined the evidence was sufficient to support defendant's robbery second and grand larceny fourth convictions. Defendant told the victim, Diaz, she would have him beaten up if he didn't give her $20. The court held the victim had been threatened with immediate use of force within the meaning of the statute. In that case, the defendant threatened the victim that she would call her friends to come and beat him up if he didn't give her the $20. And that was deemed sufficient to meet the requirement that the victim be threatened with immediate use of force. In Bacon, on page 217 and 218, the Fourth Department held that the defendant was properly convicted of assault for allowing his dog to attack the victim. The court wrote, "The victim, as well as witnesses to the attack, testified that two pit bull terriers that had escaped their owner's property attacked the victim, biting at his arms and legs, as the victim attempted to protect his dog from the pit bulls. Defendant, who was a friend of the owner of the pit bulls, arrived at the scene in a van driven by another man. Defendant exited the van, retrieved the two pit bulls, and placed them in the van. After the pit bulls were secured in the van, the victim stood in front of the van and angrily told defendant that the police had been called and you're not going anywhere. Defendant responded by asking the victim, 'You coming at me? Are you going to stop me from leaving?' At that point, defendant opened the van door and issued a command to the larger pit bull, who attacked the victim a second time, inflicting the injuries to victim's hands." In Williams, on page 219, the Second Department held that defendant shooting into the car in front of his in a high-speed chase, causing the driver to lose control and crash, supported defendant's conviction of depraved indifference assault. The next topic, automobile presumption, which deals with the possession of a weapon in an automobile. In Willingham, on page 221, the court, reversing defendant's conviction for possession of a weapon, determined the evidence was legally insufficient to support the conviction. A co-defendant was seen by the police getting into a car with the weapon. Defendant also got into the car. The police followed. Before the police pulled the car over, when the car was out of sight, the weapon was thrown out of the car. A cell phone found near the weapon was tied to the defendant, but the weapon was not. The statutory presumption that a weapon in a vehicle is possessed by all in the vehicle did not apply because the weapon was in the possession of a co-defendant when he got into the car. In Dayton Archer, on pages 221 and 222, the court, reversing defendant's possession of a weapon convictions, determined the jury should not have been instructed on the automobile presumption of possession of a weapon. The weapon was seen in possession of a passenger. Next, we look at cases that deal with the administration of a breathalyzer blood alcohol test. In Carter, on page 225, the First Department held defendant's motion to vacate his conviction on ineffective assistance grounds should have been granted. The case turned on whether defendant was intoxicated. The intoxilizer results were inconsistent, and defense counsel did not obtain a court-ordered expert. So given the inconsistent intoxilizer results, the defense counsel's failure to have a court-appointed expert review the results was deemed ineffective assistance. Burglary is the next topic. In Swinson, on page 226, the court, vacating defendant's burglary conviction, determined there was no evidence defendant intended to commit a crime, assault, when he refused to leave his wife's home. Defendant had stayed the night with his wife's permission, but refused to leave the next day. The assault occurred after defendant refused to leave. In Jones, on page 227, the Second Department determined the court properly gave the Galbo jury instruction. The court wrote, "Supreme Court did not err in giving the jury a Galbo charge." That's People versus Galbo, 218 New York, 283. "To the effect that the defendant's guilt of burglary could be inferred from his recent unexplained and exclusive possession of the stolen items." The prosecution presented both circumstantial and direct evidence, including admissions made by the defendant during a series of telephone calls, that the defendant committed the burglary and possessed the items, and there was no reasonable view of the evidence whereby the jury could have found that the defendant unlawfully possessed the property without also finding that he committed the burglary. In Burkett, on page 228, the First Department, in this burglary and robbery case, held that a weapon found in the apartment where defendant lived could be admitted in evidence as a weapon similar to that used in offenses committed at another time and place. The court wrote, "The court providently exercised its discretion in admitting a black 9mm pistol, the same type of weapon that, according to other evidence, was used in the crime. The pistol was recovered, pursuant to a search warrant, from defendant's girlfriend's apartment 3 months after the commission of the crime, and the evidence showed that defendant resided in that apartment. The evidence was relevant to show that defendant had access to that type of weapon, and it thus tended to establish his involvement in the charged crimes. The jury could have drawn a reasonable inference that the weapon was in defendant's possession at the time of the crime, and the availability of other inferences went to the weight rather than admissibility. Furthermore, The probative value of this evidence, which the court carefully limited, was outweighed, or it outweighed any prejudicial effect. Next topic is child abuse accommodation syndrome. In Ruiz, on page 231, the court, reversing defendant's conviction in the interest of justice, determined the expert evidence on child sexual abuse accommodation syndrome was improperly admitted to prove that the crime took place, depriving the defendant of a fair trial. The court wrote, "That part of the testimony of the expert describing the conduct of a typical perpetrator was not directed at explaining the victim's behavior. Rather, it was presented for the purpose of proving that the victim was sexually abused, which purpose was reinforced by the prosecutor's summation." Next, the criminal mischief. In Colbert, on page 233, the Fourth Department reversed defendant's conviction of criminal mischief, finding insufficient evidence that when she started the fire in the garage, she intended to destroy the motorcycle in the garage. There was evidence she thought the fire would be put out. Next topic is the drug factory presumption. In Johnson, on page 237, the court held the evidence was not sufficient to support the drug factory jury instruction. The court wrote, "Whereas here, the quantity of drugs found does not show circumstances evincing an intent to unlawfully mix, compound, package, or otherwise prepare for sale, giving the drug factory charge is unwarranted." There were several cases dealing with proof in gang-related prosecutions. In Reyes, on page 241, the Court of Appeals held that the defendant gang member's presence at a meeting was not enough to demonstrate he joined a conspiracy to attack the victim. The court explained, "The law does not contain a presumption of agreement based on sheer presence at a meeting at which a conspiracy is discussed. And we share the view of the federal courts that mere knowledge of the existence and goals of a conspiracy does not itself make one a co-conspirator." In Burkett, on page 241, the court held that it was error to admit a chart showing the structure and membership of a gang. The facts weren't discussed in that case, but the error was deemed harmless. In Vasquez, on pages 241 and 242, the court held it was harmless error to allow a detective to testify as an expert about the structure of the gang and the relationships among specific gang members. It was also error to admit a chart describing the structure and membership of the gang. But again, those errors were deemed harmless. In Chinloy, on page 242, the court held it was error to allow the prosecutor to cross-examine a defense witness about the witness's gang affiliation. Gang membership had no relationship to the charges. But again, the error was harmless in that case. In Jones, on pages 242 and 243, the Second Department, reversing defendant's gang-related convictions, determined that the two police officers certified as experts in gang culture served as conduits for inadmissible testimonial hearsay and acted as summation witnesses, usurping the jury's role of interpreting the evidence. The court wrote, "Here, information derived from the debriefing of arrested gang members constitutes testimonial statements within the meaning of Crawford. The more difficult question presented is whether the substance of such statements was impermissibly conveyed to the jury by the police officers in the guise of expert testimony. We find that it was. Separate and apart from the Crawford errors, The testimony, the officer's testimony also ran afoul of the proscription against police experts acting as summation witnesses, straying from their proper function of aiding the jury in its fact-finding, and instead instructing the jury on the existence of the facts needed to satisfy the elements of the charged offense. In Bailey, on page 243, the Court of Appeals held that evidence of the gang structure was properly admitted to show motive and intent and to provide background information in this assault case. The court wrote, "The testimony elicited by the people about the Bloods was probative of defendant's motive and intent to join the assault on complainant and provided necessary background information on the nature of the relationship between the co-defendants, thus placing the charged conduct in context. The testimony was intended to explain why defendant and one of the co-defendants were quick to join in the fight, as well as the gang-related meaning of the words complainant alleged that the co-defendant used during and after the attack. In fact, very little of the investigator's testimony focused on sensational details about the Bloods. The testimony described how members are identified and briefly discussed how carrying out an act of violence on behalf of a member might allow another member to rise in the gang's hierarchy." The third code word for this Criminal Justice Update 2019 CLE is dismiss. Again, the third code word for your form for this Criminal Evidence Update 2019 CLE is dismiss.